Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Chris Degenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, October 13th, 2023. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, I am going to present part 33 of my commentary on Genesis, and it is titled The Dedication of Isaac, because it really turned out not to be a sacrifice, but it certainly did have an important purpose. In Genesis chapter 21, we had last seen Abraham at Beersheba, where he had made an oath with Abimelech. The only details we have of the contents of the oath were expressed in the words of Abimelech, where we read in verse 23, "Now therefore, swear unto me here by God that thou wilt not deal falsely with me, nor with my son, nor with my son's son. But according to the kindness that I have done unto thee, thou shalt do unto me and to the land wherein thou hast sojourned." That is an oath of mutual respect and general cooperation, which would also have been passed down to each man's descendants. Then, before the oath was sealed, Abraham added the stipulation that Abimelech acknowledge the digging of the well at Beersheba by Abraham so that Abraham could keep it. And that was ensured by the grant of the 7 ewe lambs, which Abimelech had accepted. But it becomes evident much later in Genesis chapter 26 that the Philistines of Gerar had transgressed the terms of the oath. When that happened repeatedly, Isaac returned to Beersheba, where he seems to have found refuge, although apparently he had never sought any recompense for the transgressions of the Philistines. Now, the events described in this chapter of Genesis, chapter 22, are highly scrutinized and also highly criticized by various parties who are critical of Christianity because they describe the near sacrifice of Isaac by Abraham at the command of Yahweh his God. However, we would describe this event as the dedication of Isaac rather than as the sacrifice of Isaac, because the sacrifice was never completed, yet it nevertheless resulted in the dedication of Isaac to Yahweh God by his own father, who had the authority to do so. Then, as for the critics, they are generally ignorant of the seeming cruelty of the ancient world which surrounded the biblical patriarchs, and they wrongly judge this event by modern standards of society, which have themselves developed out of Christian morality, rather than judging the event by the ancient standards of society under which the patriarchs had actually lived. Yet comparing this event to many similar events which are evident in the ancient past, in the end, we must conclude that Abraham's sacrifice was an act of selflessness, whereas typically, human sacrifice in the ancient world was conducted out of acts of selfishness. For example, the pagan god Odin was said to have hung himself on the tree of Yggdrasil for 9 days and nights in order to gain knowledge of other worlds and so that he may understand the runes, the alphabet letters. But the sacrifice of Christ by hanging on a tree or a cross was so that he would redeem his people from their sins, and he himself had nothing to gain. And that was its stated purpose. Even if the critics of Christianity do not understand how the act could possibly have achieved that objective. Of course, Christians do understand that, or they should. So Odin sacrificed himself to gain something for himself, for that same selfish reason. in a historical setting, which was a little more than 6 centuries after the dedication of Isaac here. The Mycenaean king Agamemnon, when he wanted his forces to set sail in order to make war against the Trojans, was described by the Greek poets as having sacrificed his own daughter in order to appease the gods. Supposedly, as Agamemnon had gathered his 1,000 ships at Aulis in Boeotia, the goddess Artemis had caused weather which was not favorable for sailing, because she had a grudge against him. So in turn, Agamemnon sacrificed his daughter in order to appease his idol, and most of Agamemnon's companions approved of the matter at that time. While Iphigenia dies at Aulis, in some ancient Greek accounts, other later tragic poets, such as Euripides, sought to revise the account and claim that Iphigenia, as I should call her, was saved before the sacrifice could be executed, where it was claimed that Artemis snatched the girl away and substituted a deer in her place, reminiscent of this very account of the dedication of Isaac. So from that time, Iphigenia was said to have lived among the Taurians as a priestess in a temple dedicated to the goddess Artemis, as she had been dedicated to Artemis by her father when he placed her on an altar. In contrast, the tragic poet Aeschylus reflects the earlier accounts in his play titled Agamemnon, where he had described the motive for the murder of Agamemnon at the hands of his own wife, Clytemnestra, and her lover after his return from the war, as being for the express reason that he had killed his own daughter. And in that accusation, she was joined by the chorus. Another notable literary example of human sacrifice for selfish reasons is found in the Ynglinga saga, which is the first section of the Heimskringla of the Icelandic Edda of Snorri Sturluson, where the Swedish king An, or Ain, as it is sometimes spelled, A-N-E, had sacrificed 9 of his sons, since Odin had promised him an additional 10 years of life and rule for each son that he had sacrificed. There we read in part that An, or Ain, was the name of Joran's son, who became king of the Swedes after his father. He was a wise man who made great sacrifices to the gods, but being no warrior, he lived quietly at home. Then further on, we read that in Uppsala's town, Uppsala in Sweden, the cruel king slaughtered his sons at Odin's shrine, slaughtered his sons with a cruel knife to get from Odin length of life. Now, even though this King An was remembered in the Edda as a cruel man, he was also called a wise man. And the account portrays Odin, the greatest of the Germanic gods, as having approved of the king's sacrifice of his own sons, and also as having rewarded him for it repeatedly, since every 10 years he continued to sacrifice one of his remaining sons so that he could stay in power. Therefore, we see that from their own literature, which they often cite and which they claim to be holy, Germanic pagans worship a god who continually approved of and rewarded human sacrifice. Our pagan critics often complain that human sacrifice is Jewish in nature, David Duke, which also demonstrates that they are often ignorant of their own pagan literature. That's not David Duke, but it may as well be. Human sacrifice is certainly not Jewish. And neither were Abraham and Isaac Jewish. Neither was the practice restricted to Jews, or even to Canaanites, as we see here from both Greek and Germanic literature. But we would, of course, agree that human sacrifice is evil. However, neither did human sacrifice begin with Scripture. In the introduction to a translation of an ancient Sumerian epic titled The Death of Gilgamesh, and this is taken from ancient Near Eastern texts relating to the Old Testament, we read in part, Section B of the epic poem, consists of the last 42 lines of the poem. It begins with a list of Gilgamesh's family and retinue, wives, children, musicians, chief valet, attendants, and continues with the presentation by Gilgamesh of their gifts and offerings to the numerous deities of the netherworld. That is, according to at least one plausible interpretation of the available material, Gilgamesh has died and descended to the netherworld to become its king. Moreover, we must reckon with the possibility that a large palace retinue was buried with Gilgamesh. If so, we have here the first mention of human sacrifices in literature of the type uncovered by Woolley in the tombs of Ur, and we will get back to Woolley momentarily, and that Gilgamesh performs the placation rites essential to their comfortable sojourn in another world. The remainder of the poem is poorly preserved. It probably ends with a special tribute to the glory and memory of Gilgamesh. So evidently, upon the death of Gilgamesh, many in his household were sacrificed so as to accompany him into the afterlife. As for the reference to the evidence of human sacrifice, in Mesopotamia, discovered by Woolley, who was a British archaeologist of the early 20th century, we read the following in an academic journal which was originally published in 2010 by Cambridge University Press. It was published online, as my citation will contain, in 2015. But it was published in print in 2010. If anybody is curious about why there might be that discrepancy when they actually read this material. If they do, I don't know how many people that listen to me actually also read. Sir Leonard Woolley's excavation of the Royal Cemetery of Ur in the 1920s and 1930s yielded thousands of human skeletons. This is Cambridge University Press. A few of which were documented in the field or preserved for later study or exhibition. The few Woolley retained, including 21 relatively well-preserved skeletons in the Natural History Museum in London, and 10 skulls, which he had consolidated and lifted and blocked as a mass altogether, have recently been re-examined for the insight they provide into skeletal populations, mortuary practices, and the treatment of the dead in the late 3rd century BC Mesopotamia. Two skulls from the collection of the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, it's commonly called the Penn Museum, are examined using current analytical protocols and new technologies. They provide physical evidence for the sacrifice and intentional preservation of attendants buried with Ur's elites in the royal cemetery's late early dynastic phase. That phase was circa 2500 BC, as the article notes in a parenthetical remark, and it continues, and substantially revise Woolley's long-accepted reconstruction of royal funerary proceedings. This substantiates the interpretation of the events described by the editors of ancient Near Eastern texts of the death of Gilgamesh. Although Gilgamesh was king in nearby Erech and not in Ur. However, Woolley's discovery substantiated the fact that human sacrifice was conducted at Ur, perhaps over 500 years before Abraham was born, and 1,000 years before Moses had written Genesis. And Ur was the city in which Abraham was first found in Scripture, in Genesis chapter 12. So Abraham certainly must have been familiar with the practice. From this, we may conclude that human sacrifice was generally pagan, and neither Christian nor specifically Hebrew or Israelite or Canaanite, or even Canaanite, I should say. And in fact, it was often condemned in the human scriptures. I'm sorry, in the Hebrew scriptures. But it was not condemned in the Edda or in the early Greek poets, all of which were long after the act was condemned in the writings of Moses. In those writings, where Yahweh God had warned the children of Israel that he would destroy the Canaanites and that they should not follow them in their vile practices, we read in Deuteronomy chapter 12, "Thou shalt not do so unto Yahweh thy God, for every abomination to Yahweh, which he hates, have they done to their gods. For even their sons and their daughters they have burnt in the fire to their gods." That Yahweh considers such human sacrifice to be an abomination is also illustrated in the lives of the later kings of Judah. For example, in 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 3, chapter 33, verse 6, in reference to the kings Ahaz and Manasseh. So to the Hebrew Bible, human sacrifice is an abomination, where it was not an abomination to Snorri Sturluson, who wrote the Eddas, or to Homer, or to Aeschylus, or to Euripides, who wrote the tragic poems. The pagans didn't think it was an abomination. The death of Gilgamesh, the authors of that, didn't think it was an abomination. They accepted it as a fact of life. Every single one of them accepted it as a fact of life. It's only an abomination to Yahweh. But the sacrifice of Isaac was not for the purposes of sacrificing Isaac. It never was. Abraham had already had promises to Isaac that Isaac would multiply exceedingly and that his seed would be as the stars of heaven. So here, in the case of Isaac, what appears to be a demand for human sacrifice, but which had turned out to be a mere dedication, has an important place in the overall scheme of history, which was determined beforehand by Yahweh, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Israel, as Yahweh imparts both information and lessons to men on terms that the men themselves may understand, and as he determines that they require it. We cannot take it for granted that Abraham knew that Yahweh was his father through Adam, or any of the other things which had later been revealed in Christ or in the prophets. Therefore, at the time when this sacrifice of Isaac was demanded by Yahweh, not even Abraham could have known in advance all of the implications it would ultimately have for his son. So with that meager background understanding of human sacrifice in the ancient world, we shall proceed with Genesis chapter 22. Verse 1, "And it came to pass after these things," after the covenant between Abraham and Abimelech, "that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham. And he said, Behold, here I am. The Hebrew word translated as tempt here is nasa, which is to test or even to attempt, in the sense of to try or prove. It is prove in the King James Version in Exodus chapter 16, where we read, "Then said Yahweh unto Moses, Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day, that I may prove them, whether they will walk in my law or no." It is translated as tempt in places where Moses had accused the children of Israel of trying Yahweh himself, in places such as Exodus chapter 17 in verses 2 and 7 in the King James Version. So it is also where we read in Deuteronomy chapter 6, "You shall not tempt Yahweh your God as you had tempted him in Massah," referring to some of those passages back there in Exodus. So here Yahweh God had tested or proven Abraham. But we shall assert that the real purpose of the test, unbeknownst to Abraham at the time, was to have Abraham dedicate his son Isaac on the altar, which he would build to Yahweh here in this chapter. So Yahweh makes this demand. And he said, "Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of." Isaac was not actually Abraham's only son, but rather the beloved son. And the Septuagint rendering reflects that where Brenton's translation has, "Take thy son, the beloved one whom thou hast loved, Isaac." However, while the Hebrew word, yakid, may mean only, it is defined in Strong's original concordance as properly united. For example, soul, or I should say that is, soul, i.e. not, okay. By implication, beloved, and also lonely. This request was quite explicit and direct. However, it is apparent that Abraham did not at all protest, and he is immediately depicted as having complied, in spite of any grief or consternation he may or may not have experienced, and I will explain that later. And Abraham rose up early in the morning and saddled his ass and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son, and clave the wood for the burnt offering, and rose up and went unto the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. And that language implies that Abraham had been traveling until the third day. The common interpretation is that this land of Moriah describes the same place in Jerusalem where the mountain called Moriah, which was the later site of Solomon's temple, had been located. But the Hebrew term, Moriah, which means scene of Yah or Yahweh, a name which was not yet revealed, is a name which was not yet revealed to Abraham. I should say it contains a name which was not yet revealed to Abraham, the Yahweh portion of the name. So if this is indeed the Moriah, which was later a part of Jerusalem, that perhaps Moses employed another anachronism so that we would know where the sacrifice occurred, but he did not inform us of the original place, of the original name of the place in the time of Abraham. The name Moriah only appears elsewhere in 2 Chronicles chapter 3, only in verse 1. Where it was said there that that was where Yahweh appeared unto David his father, speaking to to Solomon. And therefore, that was the place where the temple of Yahweh was built. One major point against this interpretation is that in the time of Moses, the children of Israel had not yet possessed Jerusalem in order to give the mountain such a name. And they would not possess it until the time of David, when it was finally taken from the Jebusites, as it is recorded in 2 Samuel chapter 5, by which time Genesis was long completed and Moses was long dead. For that reason, perhaps we should rather accept the Septuagint version of this verse, where in Brenton's translation we read, "And he said, Take thy son, the beloved one, whom thou hast loved, Isaac, and go into the high land," instead of go into the land of Moriah, it's go into the high land, "and offer him there for a whole burnt offering on one of the mountains which I will tell thee of." However, that is not enough by itself to lead us to a conclusion. Here it is evident that Abraham had begun his journey in Beersheba, which is in the foothills which lie between the mountains and the sea near modern Gaza. On a straight line, Beersheba was almost 25 miles southwest of Hebron, where Abraham had lived before time, and nearly 45 miles southwest of Jerusalem. Having a journey of 3 days, he may be expected to have traveled at least 40 miles on the first 2 days alone, and maybe even as many as 50. A man should be able to walk 25 miles in 8 hours without killing himself. That's a rather easy pace of 3 miles an hour. While this might be consistent with a 2.5-day journey to Jerusalem, it is not quite certain that the site in question is actually later Mount Moriah of the time of Solomon, in spite of any prophetic implications which that may have. But on the other hand, verse 14 of this chapter seems to uphold the interpretation, and it is written elsewhere that Moses was a prophet. So we will discuss that subject further at verse 14. The way this account is recorded by Moses, Abraham seems to go quickly about the task which he had been requested to carry out, in spite of any sorrow that he must have felt for his son. But perhaps Abraham did not have sorrow, because he was confident that somehow, even if Isaac had died, Yahweh would keep the earlier promises which he had made concerning Isaac, which we read from the first mention of Isaac in Genesis chapter 17, that Yahweh had told him in part. He had told Abraham in part, because Isaac wasn't quite yet born. "I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his seed after him." So Abraham, believing Yahweh, continued to believe him and carried out the task which he was given while having confidence, while having full confidence in those promises. Moving on to verse 5 of Genesis chapter 23. "And Abraham said unto his young men, Abide ye here with the ass, and I and a lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and they went both of them together." The knife may have just been a piece of flint. Who knows? We don't know. Evidently, Abraham had to keep a torch or a lamp of some sort, where it says that he took the fire in his hand. Even if he had flint and iron in order to make a fire, a technique about which he must have known, it was widely known in the ancient world, flint and steel, it is difficult to make a fire in that manner even with the modern flint and steel kits, which are manufactured for that very purpose. So it was probably easier to carry a torch or a lamp, or to have a servant carry one for you. And I'm sure Abraham could do that. Works of classical and modern art, which portray the dedication of Isaac, sometimes depict him as a young child. While we do not know how much time has transpired since his having been weaned, here it is evident that he must have been old enough to be able to carry a considerable amount of wood uphill to the site of the offering, where we read that Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac, his son. That means that Isaac had carried all of the wood. The next significant event, which is recorded in Genesis, is in the opening of verses of chapter 23, and that is the death of Sarah at the age of 127 years, which is 37 years after she had given birth to Isaac. So here, Isaac is somewhere between 5 and 37 years of age. We could guess 33 years, but then I would sound like a Freemason or something. And I'm not that superstitious. But it is evident, since Isaac carried all of the wood, that Isaac must have been somewhat beyond childhood. The amount of wood sufficient to offer a young man in sacrifice must have been considerable. So Isaac must have been old enough to carry such an amount. One popular recipe, and I've said this before, one popular recipe found on the internet for cooking a whole 60-pound pig, not that we should, calls for 5 bundles of hardwood, in addition to a bag of hardwood lump charcoal. The size of the bundle is not specified, but one reseller estimates a 3/4 cubic foot bundle of hardwood to weigh between 23 and 27 pounds, depending on the variety of the wood. So the recipe for a 60-pound pig calls for 5 of them, evidently. A typical modern bag of hardwood lump charcoal sold in stores weighs about 20 pounds. So in any event, Isaac carried at least 140 pounds of fuel to the site where his father would build a fire, and possibly much more, since he must have been much larger than a 60-pound pig. Therefore, he was most likely a strong young man at the time of this event. Verse 7, Genesis chapter 23. And Isaac spoke unto Abraham his father, and said, My father. And he said, Here am I, my son. And he said, Behold, the fire and the wood. But where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, My son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went, both of them together. Not yet could Abraham inform Isaac that he was the offering. Yet this lie which he had made in his innocence turned out to be true. So once again, as we read of the prophet Samuel in 1 Samuel chapter 3, and Samuel grew, and Yahweh was with him, and there did not fall one of his words to the ground. Yahweh was also with Abraham. So these words, which Abraham had spoken, did not fall to the ground. Even if Abraham himself did not yet know what would happen. For that same purpose, David had prayed in the 19th Psalm, saying, Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Yahweh, my strength and my redeemer. Perhaps the record is purposely concise, but as soon as they arrive at the appointed location, Abraham moves forward immediately with the gruesome task at hand. And they came to the place which God had told him of, and Abraham built an altar there, and laid the wood in order, and bound Isaac his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. Obeying Yahweh, here Abraham seems to have been dauntless, which is an indication that his life experiences since he was called by Yahweh to depart from Haran must have taught him to trust in Yahweh completely, in spite of the fact that prospects of his having yet another son with Sarah were even more dismal than they had been when Isaac was born. So Abraham seemed confident that the promises to himself and to Sarah would somehow be fulfilled in Isaac, in spite of the fate of Isaac here. These things must have dominated his thoughts throughout the events which are described here. And Abraham seems to have never doubted or resisted his God in the course of their completion. The sacrifice of Isaac foreshadows the sacrifice of Christ in many ways. They were both sacrificed on a hill or mountaintop, perhaps even in the same area. And they both carried to the respective sites of their sacrifice their own wood, which was to be the method of their sacrifice, although the wood was used in different ways. Furthermore, while Yahweh did indeed provide a lamb, or actually a ram, to replace Isaac, the sacrifice of Christ was portrayed in both the prophets and the gospel as that of a Lamb of God dying, provided by God, dying on behalf of Isaac's descendants. Now, Abraham's test comes to a close. I think I confused the chapter earlier. This is verse 11 of Genesis chapter 22, I believe, and not 23. Yes, this is Genesis chapter 22. That's okay. I've done that before. It sure as hell won't be the last time. Verse 11, Genesis chapter 22. And the angel of Yahweh called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here I am, or here am I. The phrase, here am I, seems to represent a colloquial answer, such as we say hello in modern English. It is the same answer he uttered when Yahweh spoke to him in verse 1, and where Isaac had spoken to him in verse 7, where Abraham is portrayed as answering in that same fashion, even where it is evident that he and Isaac must have been within view of one another. Now, Yahweh reveals the nature of the trial. And he said, Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing that thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. This is the dedication of Isaac to Yahweh, wherein Isaac now lawfully belongs to Yahweh his God, and not to his own father. Abraham had offered his son up to his God willingly, and Yahweh had explicitly accepted the offering. Referring to this event, explaining the need for Christians to perform good works, the Apostle James had asked in chapter 2 of his epistle, Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he had offered Isaac his son upon the altar? Likewise, Paul of Tarsus wrote in Hebrews chapter 11, By faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac. And he that received the promises offered up his only begotten, or most beloved, son. And we'll explain that later. Of whom it was said, that in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Well, the Hebrew words, Kadesh, or Kadash, Kadash, Kadesh, Kadash, as they are transliterated by Strong's Concordance and others, Kadesh, Kadesh, and Kadash actually being, if I'm not mistaken, a verb, a noun, and an adjective. While those Hebrew words do not appear in this account in relation to the dedication of Isaac, they very often refer to something or someone which has been sanctified or separated for a particular reason. And in the Old Testament, usually that reason is for the dedication of the person or object to a god, and especially to Yahweh, the God of Israel. Sometimes the sanctification process is merely a ritual cleansing. Or sometimes it is a whole burnt offering, or some other purpose designated by the god. So designating that something or someone has been dedicated in such a manner, the English terms are usually translated as holy, sanctified, or of people also as saint. Therefore, even though those terms were not used here, the acts of Abraham here, which fulfilled the demands of Yahweh his God, nevertheless merit the distinction bestowed upon Isaac, which those terms describe. As Paul of Tarsus demonstrated in another way, in an analogy concerning Levi in Hebrews chapter 7, after Abraham was given the promises, he nevertheless gave tithes to Melchizedek. So the Melchizedek priesthood was superior to that of Levi, even if Levi was in the loins of Abraham when he had received the promises. Then, in Romans chapter 9, Paul had attested, in relation to the promises of Isaac, that the children of the promises of the promise are counted for the seed, referring to the promise made to Sarah. Understanding the purpose for which Isaac was placed upon the altar as a sacrifice by Abraham, one may come to the conclusion that in relation to Yahweh, the only people who could ever claim to be his are those who have originated from of the loins of Isaac. So in Ezra chapter 9 and in Isaiah chapter 6, various portions of the children of Israel were called the holy seed. And throughout Scripture, they were all described as the holy people, having become holy when they were dedicated to God in the loins of Isaac. According to Daniel chapter 12, they are the holy people even after they had been scattered abroad in captivity on account of their sins. The English word sacrifice comes from two Latin words, which are sacer, which is sacred, and the verb facere or facere, which is to do, cause, or create, among other related things. So sacrifice literally means to make something or someone sacred, to make sacred. In the ancient world, that did not necessarily mean destroying what is being sacrificed, but often dedicating it to the possession and use of the god of any particular altar or temple. In the same manner, the Hebrew word Kadesh and its related words were usually translated in the Septuagint with the Greek word Hagios, which is often holy in English, but which, according to Joseph Thayer in his Greek lexicon, More fully means, in part, set apart for God, to be, as it were, exclusively his. And in that same sense, he defines the related verb, hagiazo, in part, as to separate from things profane and dedicate to God, to consecrate, and so render inviolable. In that manner, when Isaac was dedicated, he was made sacred to Yahweh on the altar which his father had built. In like manner, the term was used among the profane Greek writers. In the intermediate edition of their Greek-English lexicon, Liddell and Scott define the adjective hagios as devoted to the gods, sacred, holy. And there the reader is also referred to the Latin word sacer, which we have already discussed here, which means sacred. The ancient Greeks set something apart or dedicated something to a god by placing it upon an altar in the temple of that god. Once that was done, the object, or even the person, became the property of the god of the temple and fell under the authority of the priests. For example, as we had discussed in reference to Iphigenia, the daughter of Agamemnon, whom he had sacrificed to Artemis in the version of Euripides, she was snatched away and became a priestess in the temple of Artemis, where she would have been expected to observe the idol. In the ancient world, unwanted children, slaves, and captives in war were often dedicated to temples. And as a result, they became temple workers or even prostitutes, raising money for the temple. Regardless of the role that they were given to fulfill, such a person in Greek was called a hierodoulos, which is a compound of words meaning temple, hieron, and slave, doulos, a hierodoulos or hierodoule, as it is often transliterated in English, is nothing but a temple slave. In another of his plays, Ion, Euripides depicted the rape of Creusa by Apollo, and how, after the birth of the resulting but unwanted infant, Creusa had left the title character, Ion, exposed in the same place where Apollo had raped her. So he had him taken to Delphi and dedicated to his temple there. I should pronounce that Delphi, according to the Greek conventions. And the Delphians made him the steward and trusted chamberlain of all the gods' possessions. And from then until now, he has lived a holy and respected life in the gods' temple. That's from Euripides. These possessions had come from temple dedications. Among the ancient Greeks, it was very common for men to take a portion of their proceeds, or war booty, or even the work of their hands, to a temple and dedicate it, hoping in return for some favor or good oracle from the god. And this was especially true of the famous oracle of Apollo at Delphi. Delphi, it's pronounced, I believe, in modern contemporary colloquial language. These practices are found throughout ancient Greek literature from as early as the writings of Homer. One famous account is related by Herodotus, who portrayed the conquered Lydian king Croesus as having been bitter against Apollo, since he dedicated to the temple at Delphi many valuable gifts after he had received an oracle which he believed was favorable. So Croesus is said to have gifted the temple with 3,000 sacrificial beasts and gold ingots, and elaborate garments, gold implements, and furnishings in vast quantity. One solid gold statue alone was said to have weighed 10 talents, which is approximately 570 of our modern pounds. Imagine having a 570-pound gold statue. But his venture to attack Persia resulted in his defeat, rather than the victory which he had expected in return for these gifts. So when Croesus sent to Delphi to inquire as to why Apollo had betrayed him, the priestess answered that he himself had failed to understand the initial oracle. And her answer read in part, "For when the god told him that if he attacked the Persians, he would destroy a mighty empire, he ought, if he had been wise, to have sent again and inquired which empire was meant, that of Cyrus or his own. But if he neither understood what was said, nor took the trouble to seek for enlightenment, he has only himself to blame for the result." So Croesus thought he had a favorable oracle. He attacked the Persian Empire, and his own empire was destroyed in his resulting defeat. And he was mad at Apollo, but the priestess is telling him that he should have blamed himself. Because of the ambiguity of the oracles attributed to Apollo, the idol was given the epithet Loxias, which Herodotus himself had also used in reference to the idol, and which is from the Greek word loxus, which is slanting or crosswise, but of language indirect or ambiguous. However, in contrast, Yahweh, the God of Israel, is not ambiguous, and his word is explicit and true. The Israelites had also dedicated objects to Yahweh at his temple, which is evident in 2 Samuel chapter 8, where David had conquered the Philistines, Moabites, and Syrians. And we read, "And David took the shields of gold that were on the servants of Hadad-Ezer, and brought them to Jerusalem. And from Betah and from Berothai, cities of Hadad-Ezer, King David took exceedingly much brass. When Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had smitten all the host of Hadad-Ezer, then Toi sent Joram his son unto King David to salute him and to bless him, because he had fought against Hadad-Ezer and smitten him. For Hadad-Ezer had wars with Toi. And Joram brought with him vessels of silver and vessels of gold and vessels of brass, which also King David did dedicate unto Yahweh, with the silver and gold that he had dedicated of all nations which he subdued." So David was dedicating war booty to Yahweh at the temple of Yahweh. In a similar manner did Jephthah sacrifice his daughter, and whereupon she and her friends lamented her virginity for 2 months, but not her life, as it is described in Judges chapter 11, whereafter it was said that she knew no man. So she lived out life as a virgin. The custom is seen in the ancient laws of Mesopotamia, in the code of Hammurabi, an Amorite king of Babylon in the 18th century BC, where we read in part, "If a father dedicated his daughter to deity as a hierodule, a sacred prostitute, or a devotee, possibly a priestess, and did not present a dowry to her, after the father has gone to his fate, she shall receive as her share in the goods of the paternal estate her 1/3 patrimony, but she shall have only the usufruct of it the right to enjoy its use as long as she lives, since her heritage belongs to her brothers. My voice is, for some reason, my throat is very dry tonight. In a 6th century BC inscription of Nabonidus, a later Chaldean king of Babylon, he is recorded as having dedicated to the temple of the quote-unquote Lord of Justice the sum of 100 talents and 21 miners of silver, corresponding in value to 5 talents and 17 miners of gold, and among other things, to Nebo. Nabonidus was named after Nebo, so was Nebuchadnezzar. The first 4 letters of both names are taken from their idol Nebo. To Nebo and Nergal, my divine helpers, I also dedicated as temple slaves 2,850 men of the prisoners from the country Huma to carry the earth baskets, because Marduk, my lord, has given more prisoners into my hands than to any of my royal predecessors. In that same manner, all of the children, both of Israel and of Esau, were dedicated to Yahweh God in the loins of Isaac. However, the dedication of Isaac was not only for good, but also in order to make an exhibition of evil, which we hope to discuss later on in Genesis in relation to commentaries on the sons of Isaac, both Jacob and Esau. When the children of Israel separate themselves from the world and turn to Christ, they demonstrate their acceptance of that fact, the fact that they should be dedicated to the service of God. That is what it truly means to be holy, sanctified, or a saint in the New Testament. This we may also read in the promise of a new covenant in Ezekiel chapter 37. And David, my servant, David as a type for Yahshua Christ, and David, my servant, shall be king over them. And they all shall have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. And they shall dwell in the land that I have given unto Jacob my servant, wherein your fathers have dwelt. And they shall dwell therein, even they and their children and their children's children forever. And my servant David shall be their prince forever. My tabernacle also shall be with them. Yeah, I will be their God, and they shall be my people, and the nations shall know that I, Yahweh, do sanctify Israel, when my sanctuary shall be in the midst of them forevermore. That word for sanctify is the Hebrew word kadash, a verb related to those same words which mean to consecrate, sanctify, prepare, dedicate, be holy, be sanctified, be separate, etc. At the start, Abraham certainly did believe that he would have to sacrifice his son Isaac, as his actions here have demonstrated. But the plan of God, as it is now revealed, was that Abraham would only dedicate his son Isaac, having relinquished him to Yahweh the moment he placed him on the altar. While his emotional reactions are not recorded, they must have been strong, but now he must have been relieved, where we next read. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him, a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son, in the place of his son. Hear the truth of the words which Abraham had spoken to Isaac earlier becomes manifest where he told him in verse 8 of this chapter that God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. The word for lamb in that passage, the King James Version often made terrible choices, I'm sorry. The word for lamb in that passage is seh or seh, Strong's number 7716, which is a general term that describes any animal of a flock, whether a sheep or a goat. So it's just a flock animal. Here the word for ram is ayil, number 352, which is more specifically a ram. But a ram could nevertheless be described by the earlier term, which is translated as lamb in the King James Version, but which was not necessarily translated as lamb. It didn't have to be translated as lamb. Another famous discovery of Sir Leonard Woolley in Mesopotamia is a statuette in which he himself had called the ram caught in a thicket, having alluded to this very account of the dedication of Isaac. But the statuette does not discredit this account. The statuette dates, like most of the other things he found at Ur and nearby locations, dates to the middle of the second millennium BC, 2500 BC. In a pastoral society, it is quite frequent that goats and rams may climb their forelegs up into the brush or onto the stumps or branches of trees in order to eat leaves, any leaves which they could reach. Some goats even climb to the tops of certain trees. There are goats in Morocco. I just found out about this today. There are goats in Morocco which actually climb to the tops of certain fruit trees that grow there that I'm not at all familiar with. Argan, they're called, A-R-G-A-N. There's a link here in my notes, in the footnotes. That's footnote number 19. Verse 14, Genesis chapter 22. And Abraham called the name of that place Jehovah Jireh, as it is said to this day, in the mount of Yahweh it shall be seen. There is academic debate over the use of the name of Yahweh reflected in the translation of the original Hebrew phrase translated here as Jehovah Jireh, which is Yahweh sees or Yahweh has seen here in the King James Version. The phrase, which we would write as Yahweh Jireh, that's how it should be written, The phrase is from the name Yahweh and a verb, ra, which means to see. The verb is prefixed with a yod, which serves as a pronoun meaning he. That's where that J-I comes from in Jehovah Jireh. J-I-R-E-H is really a pronoun, and that verb ra, which means to see. The pronoun is redundant in English in this context. We don't have to write in English Yahweh he sees, or Yahweh he has seen, depending on how we interpret the verb, because Jehovah Jireh does that for us. Yahweh sees does that for us. It may also be argued that the Septuagint supports the presence of the name Yahweh here, where in the corresponding Greek it has Kyrios Eidon, which is Greek for the Lord hath seen, in Brenton's translation. While not much of this chapter has survived in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there is one scroll which has Elohim Jireh instead, which is God sees, or God has seen. So in the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, where a fragment of this passage had been preserved, and there's only like three verses from this chapter that were preserved, portions of three verses, there is a footnote which reads, since, according to the Bible itself, the name Yahweh, translated Lord in most modern editions of the Bible, was later revealed to Moses in the book of Exodus, chapter 3, verses 13 to 15, students of the Pentateuch have long debated the use of Yahweh in the book of Genesis. A common solution, I don't buy this common solution, a common solution suggests that an early author-editor indiscriminately used the term in his copying of the text. 4Q Gen, okay, I probably shouldn't do that. 4Q Gen-EXOD, A. That means 4Q Genesis Exodus A. And the A means that it's a portion of a fragment believed to accompany other portions of the same fragment. So there's probably at least a 4Q Genesis Exodus B, and maybe even C, D, E down the line. That's a possibility. I don't know. I didn't look for the other fragments. 4Q Genesis Exodus A. That's one of the fragments of a Dead Sea Scroll. Sure to fuel the debate afresh, replaces, and they put the term replaces in quote marks, the term Yahweh in Genesis 22:14 with the more common Hebrew term for God. Thus, the familiar Jehovah Jireh becomes Elohim Jireh. And there the authors also translated Jireh from a word which is literally to see as to provide, which is one out of many figurative uses of the term where it appears in various contexts. I would simply translate it as see in the occurrences where it appears here, because it seems to be or to bear the same meaning as Moriah, and I'll explain that shortly. So while we may not accept all of their conclusions, it is certain that scribes in at least some places did make mistakes or take liberties in transcribing, whether they were accidental or purposeful. But as we have asserted on diverse occasions, Moses used many anachronisms intentionally as he is writing this account for the sake of the children of Israel. And the events themselves had taken place long before he had written. So it is very likely that Abraham called the place Elohim Jireh. But Moses knew that Yahweh, being the only true God, for that reason, I'm sorry, Moses knew that Yahweh being the only true God, I got it right. For that reason, the place should be known as Yahweh Jireh. However, even with that, it is evidently not mentioned again in Scripture, unless it is accepted to be the later place called Moriah. With that, it is also plausible that Moses did indeed intend to associate the name of this place with Moriah, which means seen of Yah, or seen of Yahweh, and which is therefore only a slightly different way of saying Yahweh Jireh. Strong's original concordance explained that the Hebrew term, Moriah, was from the same words as Yahweh Jireh, but in a different order. The first part of the word is from the same verb, ra, which means to see. However, in the name Moriah, the verb is prefixed with a mem, a letter M, or mem, which means from, And we have explained that in Jira, it is prefixed with a yod, which means he. So this is probably the best argument which upholds the assertion that Isaac was dedicated on what would later be known as Mount Moriah in Jerusalem, and it is difficult for us to disregard. So I'm sort of leaning towards that interpretation as being a correct interpretation, that Moses purposely called this place Yahweh Jireh, even if Abraham only called it Elohim Jireh, because Moses understood and therefore wanted to associate it with Moriah, because they mean virtually the same thing. The two words, Yahweh Jireh and Moriah, which is Moriah or Moriah Yahweh, actually it's a shortened form, even in Hebrew, basically have the same meaning with a slightly different expression, expressed in slightly different ways. Now Yahweh continues to speak to Abraham in Mount Moriah. And the angel of Yahweh called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time, and said, By myself have I sworn, saith Yahweh, for because thou hast done this thing, and hast not withheld thine son, thine only son, and I will interrupt here. A blessing follows in verse 17. The Septuagint has the last clause of this verse 16 to read. For now I know that thou fearest God, and for my sake has not spared thy beloved son. It also has similar languages in verses 2 and 12 of this chapter, where it also reads beloved rather than only. As we have explained in various contexts in the New Testament, where the word monogenes, or only begotten, appears in contexts where there were clearly other sons, the word is an idiom for one's most beloved son. And the Septuagint translation in these three verses and elsewhere helps to exemplify the meaning of the idiom. Ishmael was put out of the presence of Sarah, ostensibly so that he is not a threat to Isaac. But he does appear with Isaac later in Genesis, at the death of Abraham, where he comes to help Isaac bury his father, as it is recorded in Genesis chapter 25, where he is nevertheless still described as a son of Abraham. Even though he was put out, he's still a son of the flesh, as Paul would say, rather than being a son of the promise. Now, for what Abraham had done, the promise which he had received at the beginning in Genesis chapter 12 is repeated and augmented. That in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. When we discuss the call of Abraham in part 21 of this commentary, and the similar blessing that Abraham had received in Genesis chapter 12, we said in part, and I'm going to cite an entire paragraph from that presentation, while Abram could only have understood this promise within the context of his own time, in the understanding of Paul of Tarsus, looking at the Genesis account through Christian eyes, the reference to all the families of the earth was a prophetic statement which referred to the future 12 tribes of Israel, the descendants of Jacob who inherited the promises to Abraham that his seed would inherit the earth. This is what Paul had meant where he wrote in Galatians chapter 3, that just as Abraham had trusted Yahweh, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, then you know that they, from faith, they are sons of Abraham. And the writing having foreseen that from faith Yahweh would deem the nations righteous, announced to Abraham beforehand that in you shall all the nations be blessed. So those from faith are blessed along with the believing Abraham. Here, Paul's interpretation is corroborated with his promises repeated here, since where it says, "And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies," Yahweh God clearly indicates that there must be some nations which are not blessed in Abraham's seed, but which are accounted as enemies, whose gates the seed of Abraham would possess. Furthermore, where Paul said that the nations to be blessed were those from faith, he must have meant that those nations were from of the faith of Abraham, as he himself had defined it in Romans chapter 4. And therefore, the nations being blessed in his promise must be those nations which would come from the seed of Abraham and none others, because that is what Abraham himself had believed. Verse 19, Genesis chapter 22. So Abraham returned unto his young men, and they rose up and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. Now that Abraham has returned to Beersheba from the dedication of Isaac, having received yet another assurance that Isaac would indeed have a glorious future, we see the first indication of what his immediate future would include in verse 20. And I will read to the end of the chapter, because I do not have much to say about this passage. "And it came to pass after these things, that it was told Abraham, saying, Behold, Milcah, she has also borne children unto thy brother Nahor, Huz his firstborn, and Buz his brother, and Kemuel the father of Aram, and Chesed, and Hazo, and Pildash, and Jidlaf, and Bethuel. And Bethuel begot Rebekah. These eight Milcah did bear to Nahor, Abraham's brother. And his concubine, whose name was Rumah, she bare also Tubah, and Gaham, and Tahash, and Makah." And we need not elaborate on the family of Nahor, as only one of those mentioned here are relevant to the life of Isaac, or the balance of Scripture, as far as I could possibly see. It is apparent, however, that Nahor was blessed with bountiful descendants after he remained in Haran. So as Genesis proceeds, it is Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, who shall become the wife of Isaac and the mother of Jacob and Esau. Bethuel, a name which is said in Strong's original concordance to mean destroyed of God, something of which I am very skeptical, is defined by Jesenius merely as man of God, or of a place, tarrying of God, in relation to its use as a name for a town of Simeon later in Scripture. The Brown Driver Briggs lexicon agrees with the definition of the term as man of God. I did not look into the precise components and underlying details justifying that definition. When, without any dispute or any promise of anything in return, Abraham had placed his son Isaac on the altar at the commandment of Yahweh his God, Abraham was surrendering his authority over his son and dedicating him to Yahweh, whereby Isaac became the only man ever dedicated to God and accepted explicitly by God, by the explicit command of God. So unlike any other human sacrifice of the historical records, until the sacrifice of Christ himself, Abraham's sacrifice was the ultimate sacrifice which a man could make, as he was willing to give up, or at least I should say, to risk everything which he had been promised in order to please his God. But he himself had been promised nothing additional in return for that sacrifice. So his willingness to comply with the sacrifice of Isaac was entirely selfless. And it was also a type, a foreshadow of the later sacrifice of Christ. I should have more to say about this as Genesis, as we progress through this commentary on Genesis. But for now, this concludes our commentary on Genesis chapter 22. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.